be here today, so that's fine. Dropping back to Sunday school, there were some thoughts that I have been thinking about for some months in regard to our congregation. I have been asking myself the question, what does it take to create a fellowship, or for us to create a fellowship that is enjoyable? I almost want to use the word fun. Most of us don't think about church being fun, or even if church should be fun. But I think it should be fun. I think it should be fun. I think we should enjoy being here. What would it take? What would have to happen that we would say, wow, I love to be with this group of people? As I'm not sure we'd actually all say that all the time. Why not? So thinking about this, these thoughts of offending the little ones or offending one another, how do we do that? What happens that we offend one another? These are the things that I'd love for us to think about as a church, as a congregation. And why do these things happen? There's the t-shirt that you see sometimes that has this stick man on that is missing his back. And another person is standing behind him and says, I got your back. And he's holding the backbone, all right? So if something really bad happened to any one of us, I'm going through my heart stuff, all right? I feel like you got my back. However, if I goof up in my scheduling and organizing of events, and I don't get you information fast enough, pretty quick grace runs out. And that's just not just me. That's like, I think that's how we do with each other. That would challenge us to think about the grace that we extend to each other in the days and the weeks and the months of our lives as a congregation. I think we could be kinder to each other. I think we could speak words of grace to each other in better ways. When I sin, I want you to tell me that. But my ability to hear you talking to me about my sin is really diminished if most of my serious conversation with you is negative or critical. Or the vice versa, the other way around. If most of my interaction with you is critical and negative, and then I share something with you that I'm concerned about, instantly there's reaction. And so I think that if we would speak with no sarcasm, a little teasing, and a lot more kindness, we could create here a fellowship that is much better, and one where they will know that we are Christians by our love one for another. That's not my sermon this morning. It has been my thinking, things I've been thinking about in the last few months, and challenge that I would have for us, encouragement to maybe speak with more kindness one to another, more consideration, more acceptance of the fact that we don't have our act together as much as we'd like to present ourselves as having our act together most of the time. I invite you to turn with me to Genesis chapter 12. The title of my sermon this morning is The God Who Uses Our Mistakes to Further His Plans. That's a long title. The God Who Uses My Mistakes to Further His Plans for My Life. And we're going to talk about Abraham, and we're going to end with mothers. So the connection between the two is, as we raise our children, I and my wife worry about the mistakes we're making. I know I'm making mistakes. What extent is the detriment of the mistakes I'm making? Will there be grace for those mistakes? My parents made mistakes, and I know how I have related to my parents in that. And do I want my children to relate to me the way I related to my parents and the mistakes I'm making? So, you know, again, we're going back to this same thing of how do we offend one another, and how do we deal with those offenses, and what kindnesses do we offer when mistakes are made? The God who uses our mistakes to further his plans. Genesis chapter 12, 10 through 20 is what I'd like to read. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, he said unto Sarai his wife, Behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, This is his wife, and they will kill me. But they will say, Thee alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake. And he had sheep and oxen, and he asses and men servants and maid servants, and she asses and camels. He gave them to Abram. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, What is this that thou hast done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou, She is my sister, so I might have taken her to me as a wife? Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had. An incredible story. Very, very beautiful woman. So beautiful that Abram knew that when he gets into the land of Egypt, that the beauty of his wife is going to be told to the king. All right? That's a beautiful woman. If you're going to go to Germany with your wife, and she is so beautiful that you know that the government leaders are going to find out you're there because of the beauty of your wife. That's a beautiful woman. He knew, that was his sense. She's that beautiful. We all think our wives are the most beautiful in the world. But he had some comprehension that this was something extra special. And she apparently was, because it actually did happen that way. Don't know what she looked like, but she must have been a very beautiful woman. Down to Egypt, as we think about Abram leaving the promised land and going down to Egypt, was this a good thing or not a good thing? There was a famine in the land, and Abraham chose to leave where he was already in the promised land to go down to Egypt. Okay? I read a quote that says, Sometimes it is harder to remain faithful in the promised land than to enter and acquire it. The promised land is where God places us in salvation, and it is not over. There is still faithfulness. There is still walking with God. There is still walking in the Spirit that God asks of us as we go through life. And this statement is, sometimes it is harder to remain faithful in the promised land than it is to enter and acquire it. Maybe Abraham should have stayed and seen how God would have sustained him back in the promised land. Abram chose to go down to Egypt. But if you look at the promises, and God is faithful, what he had promised to make of Abram, and I gotta keep saying Abram here because he's not Abraham yet, make of Abram and Sarai, he promised them that they would have a promised child, that of them would come a nation, a tribe of people that is without number. Abraham believed God in this promise, but he doubted along the way sometimes, and in this situation, he was concerned that he was going to get killed. And so he sent his wife off to Pharaoh's house. As Abraham left his wife out of his care, God stepped in and took care of her. This one was an important woman. She was to be the father of the line that Jesus would come from. She was more important than Abraham in this scenario. Abraham was concerned for his life. But God was actually saying, no. Sarah's more important here. We got to take care of her. And so God protects her. And he plagues Pharaoh's house because of her. And ironically, one of the things that happens in this scenario is Abraham gets a financial jump on life here. He's already a wealthy man. But the Pharaoh Oh, what does he do? He produces these animals that maybe increases his wealth by a third or a half. It doesn't really say, but he was given a substantial gift of livestock when Sarai was taken into the palace. Ever after, as Abraham's wealth increased, he had to remember that the source of his wealth was his wife, not himself. That she, this was a bride price that was given to him by the Pharaoh of Egypt. Later on, when Abraham takes his young men and they go out and they rescue Lot, and there's all these spoils of war, what does Abraham say? He said, I ain't taking none, because then you're going to be able to say you made me wealthy. Abraham learned a lesson. His wealth that he got from Egypt, he couldn't claim. It was not his wealth. It was a gift to him because of his wife, Sarai. God will sustain us if only we are willing to be faithful and live by his standards and within the boundaries that he has set. So, Sarai is this knockout beauty that Abraham knew was so beautiful that even the Pharaoh would notice, and he does. And so he tells a lie. He says, she is my sister. Now, if you go into the Bible and you study this out, I didn't, and I'm not going to try this morning. A lot of Bible scholars would believe that he was really telling a half-truth, or at least a partial truth, that she was relative to him in some way, that her mother was not the same as his or something like that, or somehow she was either a half-sister through marriage or a second marriage, or some think that maybe she was a niece of his in some way. I don't know if the Bible is terribly clear about that, and we're not going to try to unpack that. But Sarai, for whatever reason, goes along with the plan, and she does what Abraham asks her to do. Maybe it has to do with her honor of him. Hebrews tells us that she called him Lord. So at any rate, she goes along. For all practical purposes and reality, Abraham tells a lie. And if it was not a straight-out lie, it was at least an intended deception, that he was intending to deceive the Egyptians into believing that this was not his wife. And in reality, it was his wife. So he was acting on his own best interest. But God acted in Sarah's behalf because she was the mother of the child of promise. She was the mother of the child of promise. She was going to be preserved to be that person that God needed to birth the nation of Israel. God sends them back out of Egypt with wealth. Abraham would always have to remember that his wealth came in part through this deception of the Egyptians and the betrayal of his wife. Sarah's time in the palace, I think, is a foreshadowing of the future slavery of the Israelite people in Egypt. And her freedom foreshadows the deliverance from Egypt, and the wealth that was given to Abraham foreshadows the plundering of Egypt's wealth that Israel did 400 years later. All this kind of matches. She's in the palace. She's a slave. She can't leave unless they let her. And then they send her packing and say, take all your wealth and get out of here. And that's what happens later on. So, no matter what you are today, no matter who you are today, take heart. Your mistakes, my mistakes, are not failures that are the end of my life. My mistakes today, your mistakes today, are not failures that end your life. They feel like that sometimes in the middle of them. But that's not the end of life. They're detours. They are opportunities that God is going to use to further his plans. If we are willing to repent, if we're willing to go on with life without allowing roots of bitternesses to grow in our hearts, God then is able to take the mistakes and the problems that we get ourselves into and turn them into these gems of beauty. God is greater than any mistake that we can make. Today is Mother's Day. As mothers, really as parents, we fear making mistakes as we raise our children. God is greater than our failures. And so I offer this story of Abram to you as a thought today in regard to how we function, how you function as mothers. I know that you struggle. Are you getting it right? Are you doing all that you should do? Or am I doing all I should do? Mothers, do you keep in mind that God has plans for your children? Maybe even great plans. I would like to spend a little bit of time, turn with me to Exodus chapter 2, and think about the mother of Moses. Moses was one of the greatest leaders of Israel. And his mother's name was Jochebed. Jochebed. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about Jochebed. But I think she was an incredible lady. If you think through what she did, one of the things that amazes me when we're going through difficult schedules and times and circumstances of life is the resilience of a woman. We men are the ones who stand on the ship and link arms and die when the ship goes down, and we put women into the boats, you know, like they did on the Titanic. But the resilience of a lady to deal with life when things are really hard is kind of amazing to me sometimes. They can bear up in strength when we men are fainting. I doubt that when Jochebed looked down into Moses' little face, I doubt that she said, I'll bet God's going to use this little man to deliver Israel one day. I don't know if she did or not. It does say that she beheld that he was a goodly child. So I don't know what that means. It may mean that she looked at him and sensed she and what was her husband's name? Amram? I think it was Amram was her husband. As they looked at Moses, they may have sensed in their hearts that God has a special purpose for this child. I don't know that. But it says that he was a goodly child. I don't know if any of us look at our children and say, well, that's not a good child. You know? So, that it's actually stated kind of means something in my mind, I think. Of course we think our kids are good. But he was a goodly child. And so, let's read first before we keep going here. Verse 1, chapter 2, Exodus chapter 2. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done with him, to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. Now, I'm going to pause there just for a little bit, and we'll come back to this again, but the power of a tear is incredible. The power of tears to move hearts is absolutely amazing. When you are dealing with children or a spouse, and suddenly there are tears running down the face, that takes this conversation or this interaction to a whole new level. If you're a wife and your husband starts crying, man, that's a big deal. Or vice versa, you're talking with your wife and suddenly there's tears, man, that just pulls something out of us men that wasn't there before. Same thing with the children. So tears are an incredible thing. And I believe that God caused Abraham or Moses to cry right at this point. The babe wept, and she had compassion on him. Verse 6. And she said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it, and the child grew. She brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and became her son. She called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. So, as I think about mothers today, When Jochebed was taking Moses and placing him in the river, I doubt in my mind, as I was saying, I don't think that she did this because she had this comprehension that this is some amazing child who's going to deliver Israel. I think it was more the protective instincts of a mother. One of the things that Mark Lowry tells in some of his stories or whatever he does with comedy there, he talks about the most convincing thing about Jesus' deity to himself is Mary at the cross. So Mark was this very troubled child with all kinds of ADD and all kinds of whatever, and he exasperated his mother. But he says, if you would be taking him, Mark, to the edge of town and placing him on a cross, his mother, in his words, would be pitching a fit. And she wouldn't be standing silently at the cross and letting it happen. She would say, he's crazy, but don't kill him. All right? He's an idiot, but don't kill him. And so Mary was silent at the cross. She didn't say. Like, Jesus was crucified because he claimed to be the Son of God. Okay? Mary didn't argue with that. She didn't say, look, I know he is. He is not the Son of God. All right? No, Mary knew who he was. She knew of anybody that was the virgin birth. She was convinced that he was the Son of God, and so she was silent at the cross. The protection in a mother's heart when your child is being crucified would be over the top. And Mary was silent at the cross. That's significant as we consider the deity of Christ. So, Tony says, let's make it practical. When I think of mothers and their protection of children, you guys, your mothers don't hate me now, but when I experience moms who come to school and they say, can I speak with you privately, my blood pressure goes out the roof and my heart rate goes to 110, all right? Some self-described mothers here use the word mother bear, all right? And so when I was talking there in Sunday school, you know, when we deal with the children, we can cause the fire to shoot from their eyes, all right? This is not a bad thing. This is a mother's protection level. God created her to be that way. God intended for her to have that kind of protection feel over her children. So I think Jochebed was doing what a natural instinct was calling her to do, to preserve at all costs the life of her child. She was under threat that if the Egyptian guards or taskmasters or soldiers would find her son, they were going to kill him. And so she was taking precautions to make sure that didn't happen. She was not going to give this child up easily. That mother bear characteristic was alive and well. It's a God-given trait that we honor in you, terrifying as it may be to be on the wrong side of that. Jochebed protected. She planned. She acted. Incredible. Jochebed was willing to give up Moses for the time being. This is a challenge for your mothers. Jochebed was willing to give up Moses for the time being because his life was preserved. That takes some grit to do what Jochebed did. Her intuition told her it was the right thing to do. So here we are in the bulrushes. Miriam is stationed to look over the baby. We don't know how old Miriam is, but later on, she and Aaron are with Moses. So they're not, you know, terribly far apart, you know. They're in the same family, so they're within 10, 12 years of each other here, even if they are that much older. The Egyptian princess comes down to take her bath in the river. Says to wash herself, whatever that means. And she comes down and she goes into the river. Her eyes catches this arc of in the flags and the bulrushes by the river. Her getting in the water maybe makes it rock, disturbs the baby. She sees it. She opens it up. He starts weeping. She's crying. And Miriam, too, is intriguing. We don't know how old she is, but she comes. Like, this is some serious thinking on your feet, unless there was already a plan. She comes up and she says, would you like me to call a Hebrew nurse for you? And the Egyptian lady said, well, yeah, that'd be great. And she goes and gets her mother. Now, I don't know if they had that plan, but if they didn't, that's some pretty amazing thinking for a 12 or 13-year-old girl to pull that off in a moment's notice. God's working here. God is taking care of Moses just like he took care of Sarai. Moses, God had a plan for, and he was going to preserve him alive. And he used Egypt to do it. I think that's pretty neat. He used Egypt to do it, just as God used Egypt to preserve Sarah also. So, mothers, raise your children. Don't do it in fear. Do it in faith. Do it in faith. Have faith. You alone are not raising your children. We, as parents, are not alone raising our children. They're God's children. We are stewards of their lives. And when we hang on to them really tightly, we tend to lose them faster than if we trust them to God. So let's raise our children in faith, not in fear. These stories that we read in the Bible, they're not accidents. God is fully in control. He had it handled. The doubt that comes is when we see it from a human perspective. God has gifted each one of us, mothers, with the gender tools that you need to raise your children. God has gifted us fathers with the gender and the tools that we need to do our job. We have a strength and a fortitude too to go out and provide for our families. You have a strength and a fortitude to deal with the matters at home and in raising the children in special ways. Fulfill the role that God has designed for you. Last night, we were at Walmart, and as we checked out for the self-checkout line, there was a 60-year-old grandmother sitting there holding this tiny little baby. And it was a cute little baby, but you could see it was really young. So as we were leaving, Sheila stops and talks with this lady. And I'm stepping back about 5 feet or so away, just kind of listening, because this conversation is obviously going to last for a while. And so I'm just observing. And as I observed this scenario, as people kept coming out of the self-checkout area, almost everyone observed these two elderly women and this tiny little baby talking and laughing, and that you don't even know who she was, right? There's no name. They don't even know who they are. They don't even know names. They didn't talk about names. But they were discussing. They do know how many children each one has. They do know how many grandchildren each one has. They know who's healthy and who's not in the family. But they don't know who each other are. It's really intriguing to watch. And all, everybody came by and was grinning at this, everybody knows this tiny little baby. I'm standing 5 feet away, all right? I'm there too. Nobody ever looked at me the whole way, all right? I was like not there, okay? Mothers. And as I was standing there, I realized that I was observing. I'm thinking about mothers, all right? Well, I'm planning to preach this, so I'm observing a real example and celebration of life and motherhood. All right, a grandmother is still a mother, and those grandmothers there, Sheila with Cora right now, you move to injure that baby, and things are going to come unglued. Right, there's protection levels here that God has placed. So that was a situation that happened there that really really intrigued me as I was watching it. What is your response? What are you thinking this morning as you hear this this morning? So it's 20 after 11. We've got a few minutes here yet. Do you have a testimony or do you have a story about your mother or your wife as she mothers your children? Do you have anything to share this morning? I'm going to give a few minutes. One of the things that I feel is that as I was talking about us as a congregation, learning to be kind, one of the other things that we don't do, and I don't know, I think it's kind of innate in who we are as people, we're afraid of making each other proud. So we're afraid to pat each other on the back. Today's Sheila's birthday. She's 50 years old today. No, tomorrow. Tomorrow. Tomorrow's her birthday. I'm thinking birthday today, all right? Tomorrow's her birthday. She's going to be 50 years old. And over the years, Mother's Day and her birthday have kind of become this intertwined thing, as we either celebrate the one or the other. And but this week, or one of the big deals in Sheila's life this week was the passing of Mary Brzezinski. Mary Brzezinski was a very close friend of Sheila's, almost a mother-type figure in her life. And Mary's passing is one of the bigger events of this year. And so we made really good friends with their children along the way in the last couple of years. And their children have blessed our life as we've related with their mother and father, specifically Sheila's relationship with them. And so I'm going to read a card that was sent to Sheila this week. It says, "Sheila, if life is measured by the way we live, the way we serve, and the way we give, if life is measured by the words we say, the love expressed along the way, if life is measured by the smiles we share, the kindnesses, and the way we care, then your life's measure is clearly known, for these are all the things that you have shown." And as I know Noelle, as she wrote that card, I mean, she picked this card. She means everything that she's saying in that card. And so I honor my wife as her 50 years and her role that she has played in the community with people. And I bless her in that. So, what is your response? Do you have something to say this morning? What is your testimony? What do you have a story? If you have a story about your mother, stories tell 1,000 words beyond saying you love her. Anything. That's all I have to share.
I made a lot of mistakes, and I just pray every day that God's grace will fill those gaps. And, you know, I say that same thing to my children. We didn't do it perfectly. We won't do it
perfectly. I remember a particularly difficult time of my life when I was going through some hard stuff and taking some criticism that my mother-in-law, I don't know what she did. She patted my back, gave me a hug. And her words were, "I don't care what anybody's saying, I believe in you." That sticks to me with me today. That was 25 years ago. But it didn't matter. I mean, I was wrong. I knew I was wrong. She didn't care. She had my back, no matter what. It was mother-in-law. Anyone else? All right, if there's no others, we're going to look to Jethro to lead us in a song, and then we'll stand for a closing prayer. Jethro.